On today's episode, EDI in Times of Crisis, with special guests Catherine O'Neill from the YWCA in Edmonton and Jake Stika from Next Gen Men. Welcome to Exclusion, a podcast that explores all things equity, diversity, and inclusion in the workplace. Exclusion is brought to you by Canadian Equality Consulting, MBR Consulting.
Hi, everyone. It's Marcy and Alicia here, and it's so lovely to see you as well. So Alicia and I, this is our first podcast that we're recording where we're also accompanying a video. And today's topic is focused on equity, diversity, and inclusion in a time of crisis, specifically during the current COVID-19 pandemic. So we're joined by two fantastic guests today, both currently in the not-for-profit sector. We have Catherine O'Neill from who's the CEO of the YWCA Edmonton. And we have Jake Stika, who's the executive director of Next Gen Men. So we're trying something new here and recording in these dual mediums. So you will be able to find this discussion as a recording on our podcast Exclusion platform and shortly thereafter a video.
As always, in the spirit of respect, reciprocity, and truth, we acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the traditional territories and oral practices of both the Treaty 6 and Treaty 7 region in Alberta and Region 3 Métis Nation. We are also recording on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples. We acknowledge all nations, Indigenous and non, who live, work, and play on these lands, and to all who assist in their stewardship for generations to come.
So before we jump into the discussion, I'd like to introduce a few of our two wonderful guests. So we have Catherine O'Neill, who joined the YWCA Edmonton as CEO in March. She's a passionate advocate for the rights of girls and women and inspiring people to hear the important call to community service. Catherine has worked in leadership positions in communications and politics throughout her career. A writer by trade, she spent most of her journalism career working as a national correspondent with the Globe and Mail, dispatching stories from across Canada and even the dusty battlefield of Afghanistan in 2008. Yes. After leaving journalism, Catherine led several organizations, including the Progressive Conservative Association of Alberta and Alberta Together, which is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit that conducted political research and worked to attract more young Albertans to enter politics. She also ran a communications company that specialized in crisis communications and media relations. Catherine has volunteered on and led several not-for-profit boards, including some with a focus on early childhood education, literacy, and disability services. So thank you so much for joining us, Catherine. We also have Next Gen Men's Executive Director, Jake Stika. So Jake is a passionate speaker and facilitator focused on gender-based issues related to the social and emotional development of young men, the health and well-being of men in communities, and gender equity in the workplace. Jake was recently named one of Avenue Magazine's top 40 under 40, as well as having earned recognition from Ashoka, the British Council, and the Canadian Centre for Diversity and Inclusion. He has spoken at the United Nations as part of the Canadian delegation and participated in the UN Women Safe Cities Initiative Global Forum. He's also a proud advisor to the Calgary Immigrant Women's Association and Canadian Women in Sport. So thank you so much, Jake, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, before we jump into our discussion today, I wanted to do a little bit of a background just so that everyone is on the same page, including our listeners. It's not been hard to find discussions and articles about the gender component of the current pandemic. And our plan today is to dig a little deeper into many of these topics. But you know, I'm the geeky scientist, so I had to do a little bit of background checks on this. And I found some stats about the frontline workers that are dominated by women right now. And so here's some of the stats that I found. So if you look at nurses, so RNs, NPs, RPNs, psychiatric nurses, 92% are women. Medical lab technicians, 80% women. Respiratory therapists, 75% women. Personal support workers, so example, home care, 90% women. Now, the doctors are actually a bit more balanced, with over 40% being women. And a breakdown here is 45 would be more in family medicine, whereas 36 are specialists. But what's interesting is for doctors under 40, 44% are women. Teachers, 77% are women. Early childhood educators and assistants. So these are our TAs, our EAs and whatnot, who have been in the news quite a lot here in Alberta lately. 96% are women. Child care workers, 99% women. Community and social services, so this would include our not-for-profits, are 75 and 80% the staff are women. Cashiers, 84% women. Food preparation and services, 72% women. And cleaners, 71% women. So you can definitely see when you look at this list how much we are leaning on many female part of our population. And of course, with this, we have some added complexities where the children are all home, and there has been obviously information how this is affecting women more than their male counterparts. So I'm sure in families they are trying to navigate that. And when you look at volunteering, housework, other domestic tasks, overall caregiving, since we've lost the majority of our childcare options, that this is definitely once again affecting women within the homes and within the workforce, since many of us are working from home. So with this all in mind, we wanted to dig a little bit deeper with the work that you've been doing and kind of not just looking at it broadly, but to jump in a little bit further into what are some of the complexities that we're not thinking about or that we haven't seen in the news. So I'm going to start with you, Catherine. What have you been noticing with some of the work that you've been doing?
You know, well, all those stats you just listed, that's obviously been on our radar. And it's very comparable to past crises. Like we even go back way back into history to the 1918 Spanish flu. Women, very same on the front lines, the nurses, the caregivers. So it's history does repeat itself. On the other side of it, the vulnerable populations, women are unfortunately are in more vulnerable situations, things like domestic violence situations. We're really preparing as a sector for what we're very worried about is an epidemic of domestic violence. Also violence involving children and people living with disabilities and elder abuse. So those kind of things are really, even though we're still in the early days of this crisis and we haven't seen the numbers rise yet, we can look at other jurisdictions that have already had the COVID crisis and see that that's going to be a very big, our agencies like ours and shelters and the police are really preparing for something that we've never experienced before on that front. So it's women are out there on the front lines helping people. And also we're also unfortunately a very vulnerable population in our homes.
So in Calgary, with the YWCA here, what they're noticing is that they're preparing for this influx, but they haven't seen it yet. And no. they're wondering if it has the idea of maybe these women don't have phones. They can't, if they can't leave their house, they can't possibly find a way to even contact those that can help them. And it definitely opens up these other topics about lack of technology, lack of just even space to find a way to get support.
Yeah, there's so many reasons. And, you know, domestic violence, the abuser often isolates the person that they're abusing. So that's already happening long before a COVID crisis. So during a period where we're self-isolating, it becomes even more of a threat. So we really are reaching out. There's a lot of public service announcements and campaigns being done in Edmonton and other communities about how does a community help women in need, and checking in on your neighbors, checking in on your loved ones, checking in on your family members to make sure that you're connected and really looking for the signs of an unsafe home.
And Jake, from your point of view, because you may come at it from a different angle with some of the work that you've done, what are some of the key things that you've been seeing?
Well, there's so much to dig into. I think that, you know, a lot of these issues, you know, we really have to take this opportunity as a societal and a cultural reset is my hope as we move forward through this, because, you know, those statistics, overwhelming statistics of, you know, female dominated workplaces, you know, we've done a lot of really great work to advance women in science, technology, engineering, math, leadership, politics, you name it. But I'm missing from kind of our perspective of like engaging men and boys and really trying to change perceptions of what men can aspire to be, right? Beyond that protector, provider type role, nurturing, caregiving. And I, unfortunately, a lot of the type of language we use, whether it be even talking about statistics or pay, is, you know, pink collar jobs, and it already just rolls off the tongue as less than. And, you know, when I look at the future of where society is going and whatnot, this is the sandwich generation. We're going to be taking care of our kids and our parents at the same time. And, you know, we need more men to be able to see themselves in those types of roles. And something that keeps me up at night is, you know, the top two jobs in Canada are retail associate and truck driver. And we know which genders work in those roles. And retail associate, you know, there's online shopping and those kinds of things, but that work will still kind of exist because it's, you know, emotional labor. It's greeting people, making them feel okay, taking them on a journey of a transaction. Truck drivers, we're 5 years away from autonomous trucks being on our highways. And you know, what are those men going to do with their careers? How are they going to value themselves? And, you know, I live in BC now, but 17 years of my life in Alberta, it's my home province. And I think about, you know, this COVID pandemic, as well as this, you know, Russia-Saudi oil price war and the impact it's having on the male-dominated industries there. And we are going to see a spike in domestic and family violence, which is very unfortunate. We're also going to see a spike in suicide rates, unfortunately. And we're going to see a rise in online vitriol and tension and those kinds of things. And I think it's really important as organizations to kind of get ahead and create space for those types of conversations. And then if I could just add from our perspective, you know, we've created an initiative to try and create space for conversations men don't traditionally have. And just last night we did a session for dads and how they're dealing and coping with this. And, you know, if they have partners who are those frontline workers and they're taking on that primary caregiving role and the adjustments that they're seeing through that. Some of them, it's, you know, a lot of upskilling on a very fast pace, and some of them live in more gender equitable households and it's adding that burden. But we know that fathers are three times more engaged with their children this generation, yet it's still very stigmatized. So there's hopefully an opportunity for leaders to show, you know, I'm home, I'm caregiving, I'm taking a role, and we can start to normalize those things. So hopefully there's a tension there, but also an opportunity.
Now, what's interesting about talking about some of those jobs, whether it be within the oil and gas sector, which I actually found those stats too, and 15% within there are women. So that obviously that's a male-dominated sector. And with the truck drivers, 3% are women. So very much male-dominated industries. But it also shows you that in those situations, those people are not home. They cannot be home. They have to be on the road, which in itself can create lots of issues, mental health issues and whatnot. But it also leaves the home front, which was already stressed, even more stressed, because if a family has to have a member that's away, then it's even more stress put on the home, whether it be for caregiving of children or caregiving of the elderly. And it also can create divisions that we didn't even... It almost seems like this this pandemic is taking everything in our society where we weren't really quite figuring it out yet and just putting a finger on it and saying, ha-ha, there's a spot you were missing. Does anyone have anything to say about that, Catherine?
Well, yeah, and often crises like this can entrench inequities. So, you know, we see more frontline, like women being on the front lines, taking on those additional home caregiving roles at home with their elderly parents, things like that. And also just women during crises are often excluded from the big decision-making tables where, you know, we aren't as overrepresented in we're not equal when it comes to politics. So we're not at the table in numbers where we should be. So they kind of get exemplified during a crisis. And so we really have to take stock and say, are we going to let this stay like this? Or are we really, what you just said, kind of seeing the silver linings and what we can change? Because dads and moms are both at home right now. So let's figure out how dads can take on as much or more of the roles, because both parents are often working at the same time. And so I think it's everybody's seeing it's being magnified in a way that's really important. And now it's our job as a society to look at it and say, what do we want to fix and how can we fix it? And showing people how to get there, because often people see that there's an issue, but they don't know what the roadmap is to fix it.
I can't attribute this quote, but it's my favorite one that's come up out of the pandemic, but it's, pandemics don't break things. They just show what's already broken.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Really great.
If I just think about that, like, it's that cultural roadmap, right? Like, oftentimes we think about it as a policy here or something there. And those are often band-aids, because culture lags policy. And so we really need to think about what kind of culture we want to cultivate and create through this and out of this moving forward.
100%. I think it's a really, this is a learning opportunity, and it has slowed us down, and it has totally shown what needs to be fixed in a way that we can't ignore. And I'm hopeful because we're not even quite even to the middle of this crisis yet. So we shall see.
Exactly. I like how you brought up earlier, Jake, again, talking about equitable parenting. And how, we need to create this. This is an opportunity and a turning point for our society where we can shift things a little bit to make it more equitable. You know, I often think about, there's schools closed, daycare is closed. There's all these home care responsibilities being placed on people, or homeschooling responsibilities, but then also all the rigorous cleaning that is being recommended that has to be done like twice or three times a day. And, who does that typically fall to? And how can we share the load? And reduce the burden on people individually. And at times like this in crises, and in general in disaster response and disaster prevention, and then in the aftermath of rebuilding, an EDI lens is almost rarely ever used or applied, right? And EDI, equity, diversity, and inclusion for our listeners. And equity, diversity, and inclusion focuses on people and is people-centered and puts people first to understand the unique impacts it'll have on different types of people. So to be effective, you need to have and to apply that type of lens to your work. And then we touched on this a little bit, but I'd like to get your thoughts on this a little deeper when we talk about, gendered occupations and almost gendered segregation within different occupations. And we mentioned kind of the trucking industry and how, it's overwhelmingly male dominated, same with oil and gas. And then we look at the healthcare industry, right? And how female, how many more women are in that industry. And it's too bad we don't have it would be interesting to look at the statistics of other diverse gender options beyond just kind of sex or binary male and female. So that also reveals the lack of data that we have. But it's interesting when we look at these gendered occupations and what is valued in society, right? Where are the higher paid workers versus the lower paid workers? And then how do we place value on those occupations? So traditionally, women dominated occupations are given less value and less income, right? And unless maybe you have a direct impact with it, like for instance, the healthcare industry with a nurse, if you've been ill or you have an elderly parent that has had to be in the hospital or whatnot, and you have firsthand contact with someone, with a woman in that sector, then your value on that goes up a lot. And then you really understand the true importance of that job. But unless that's happened, so it's interesting because now you often see all these comments and these memes being shared on social media about how we should pay teachers or we should pay healthcare workers or nurses $1 million, things like that. Because now we're finally seeing, we're visible to the value that they bring. So what are your thoughts on that,
Jake? I would say, okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Jake.
You were raring at the bit.
I was raring at, you know why? Because beyond even teachers and nurses, which all the money, because it's as a home parent, I'm homeschooling right now. So it's, but beyond that, we're seeing the value of cashiers and the people who make our economy run. And what really I think has shown us is that, you know, there are, we need to have more protections for those workers, you know, paid sick leave. Many will work because there's no, you know, those safety nets for them to take time off if they're sick or not there. And, you know, even the fact getting childcare during this period is really difficult. And, you know, as during a crisis, not seeing the fact that if you're an essential worker during this period, we should be providing childcare. And I know, you know, it's a very expensive time right now for all governments, but this is a crisis where we want to make sure the health and welfare of our society is put first. And we haven't taken care of those big questions, like how do we make sure that if someone's sick, they can stay home and still, you know, make money, that their children are taken care of when they're working. These are big questions that we need to address during this crisis because it's happening in real time.
I was talking with Marcy and Alicia earlier. This is why it's so important to have a gender-based plus analysis, right, on all of these things, because there are ripple effects out there. And I just want to go back and echo again, like how thoughtful we have to be and how we value those things is embedded in our tax code, right? The fact that we tax labor more than we do capital gains, right? People will gravitate towards capital gains where they can create wealth creation. And that's where men find themselves, right? And a lot of the lower labor type jobs are left to, you know, newcomers, women, some of the more marginalized populations, which aren't seeing the benefits of the fruits of their labor. So, you know, just really thinking and zooming out, you know, where are these things actually broken from, and not just having knee-jerk reactions to what is happening on you know, some sort of stock market or those kinds of things.
Well, and that, and those are really interesting comments, because if you look at like Marion Waring, who talks about trying to find ways to value women's time, or in just in general, valuing time as opposed to maybe, like you said, the capital gains, or how our GDP is designed based on, like, it is more advantageous for us to be in the product of war than it is for caring, according to a GDP, for example. But what's also interesting is about workers' rights, like you mentioned, and how some of the frontline workers here, for example, cashiers, are now getting pay raises. There's groups like Safeway that have been in, I believe, in collective bargaining for months now, trying to get more rights. But what's also interesting, even from a scientific point of view, is they're noticing that since we all stayed home, the actual typical flu has just died because we're not spreading it. And so it shows you that if people don't have sick leave, they have no choice but to go to work every day. And yeah, then they have no choice but then to get their coworkers sick, or the public sick, because they themselves don't have any social net to fall back on if they need to stay home ill. So it's showing how, why can we do this now, but not on the everyday, and how if someone's really looking at their bottom line, that it's advantageous for them to understand that something like a sick leave is actually beneficial to them. Or university students, for example, are mentioning maybe someone with a disability that they're saying, I can never get my prof to tape his lecture so that I can see it later because I'm someone who cannot physically make it to class. But now, all of a sudden, because the pandemic, it's okay to record lectures and to watch them later. So it's showing you how there's many aspects of society that have been asking for some of these changes, structural changes, for quite some time, that now we're just realizing, oh, we actually can do these things. Man, I could have done so much over email. I didn't have to have all these face-to-face meetings.
Yeah, and just to kind of build off of that, is it's interesting is that, and in doing this and creating those kind of forcing those innovations to happen, some companies still are kind of unsure how long this is going to last. So they're trying to do the bare minimum when there's a real opportunity to apply that gender-based analysis plus lens, or an EDI lens, right? So there's so many different ways that you can make remote working more accessible and more inclusive for people. And that includes, you know, live captions, screen readers, magnifiers, keyboard shortcuts, things like that. So it's so important to make sure that that is still included.
If I could just add, you know, one thing that's very frustrating is, you know, a practitioner in kind of the EDI space in, you know, capitalistic markets, it often exists within some sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs where, you know, this is a nice to have, this is when we're seeking identity and belonging. And a lot of companies right now are going to go back to, you know, seeking food and shelter. And it's going to decimate a lot of the work and the gains that we've tried to make in these spheres. And I would love if organizations doubled down on the investments in equity, diversity, and inclusion. They're going to get far more out of their staff. You know, they're going to get better returns. Their customers are going to appreciate them more. That investment is actually a way to get through this better than you were before.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Now, both of you come from a not-for-profit background. And I find, because I am also from a not-for-profit background with the Alberta Women's Science Network, and one of the things that I've noticed is I think it's really great that governments are giving funding for things like food banks and shelters and whatnot, and they're throwing all this money at the, you know, the charity and not-for-profit worlds, but these are dominated by volunteer labor. And I'm having some issues with how this is being pushed out, knowing that it's very hard for not-for-profits to, for example, create procedural ways of making sure everybody's safe. Their volunteers may be from higher risk areas, whether it be retirees or those from lower brackets of income and whatnot. So they themselves are dealing with lots of economic and vulnerable issues. And I'm wondering if you guys have any ideas of how we could do this better. I know I have a cousin who's in the Army. She has been spending the last month writing procedures. She's the occupational health and safety person, and she's been writing procedures to make sure that any soldiers that are doing any work are doing it safely. Like, I'm always wondering if, for example, like a food bank, if it would be more advantageous to actually bring reservists in who have the proper health and safety procedures that they can bring with them, as opposed to not-for-profits trying to ramp up and to make everybody safe while they're trying to help society. Is there other ways that we can make some structural changes to make sure that we're not putting all of this burden on volunteer or unpaid labor?
Everyone's going to be tired of me this podcast, because I'm just going to talk about the structural issues that are broken over and over again. But, you know, it comes down to, again, like charities and nonprofits don't actually have a home in the government right now. We're represented by the CRA, which is more of a regulator than actually an advocate. We're handcuffed in doing a lot of the good work that we want to do. You know, I'm a nonprofit, not a charity, not me personally. Next Gen Men is a nonprofit, not a charity. And, you know, there's certain barriers that we face in and around this, and we don't have champions right now. And then go on the other side of that, and you look at community foundations across Canada who, you know, are sitting on billions of dollars right now for, you know, a rainy day. And I ask, you know, if not now, then when? Yet many of them are sticking to their 3.5% dispersal on an annual basis, while before they were making in the market 11% year over year. And so, you know, I think that, again, there's an opportunity here to mobilize and invest in these important parts of the fabric of society. I think that something like 8% of Canada's GDP flows through nonprofits and charities. There's probably 3 million workers across those sectors. It's again marginalized. It's largely dominated by women. You know, if men do get involved in certain volunteer type capacities, many of those opportunities maintain the status quo. So it's within political associations and those kinds of things, while women take up the role of you know, increasing the fabric of society. So I think, again, there's a gender-based lens to be applied there.
Well, it is really, this is going to be a very critical time for not-for-profits across the country, because many operate on very tight budgets, obviously, and And including ours, like we have, and there'll be less donations. There's going to be less funding coming. So we're really going to have to make a lot of creative decisions about keeping staff and services. And what's going to be interesting is the demand for our services are going to do this, and the capacity for us to deliver is going to do this. And if all governments, municipal, provincial, federal, really need to understand that what happens when the not-for-profits start disappearing, because there's going to be a lot that don't make it out of this. And when, you know, those services that they just took for granted were provided, what's going to happen? And it's, you know, I'm very concerned that a lot of people are going to be left behind in this crisis if we don't, you know, confront that issue right now. You know, the YWCA Canada has really said to the federal government, we need a huge injection of cash for the not-for-profit sector because of the fact that many of us across the country are doing these services. You know, we help with disability services in our own counseling for domestic violence survivors, big things that if it was just pulled away, it'd be a big problem in our community. So that's something that we're all mindful of, and we're trying to collaborate and do a lot more with less. We're doing most of our stuff virtually, you know, by phone and video, but a lot you can't, you know, stuff, you know, we have workers that go in and help provide care to people living with disabilities. And those people, we have to take their health and safety and all those extra precautions into play at all times, because they're, you know, right now on the front lines of this crisis. But if that care wasn't there, you know, what would happen to those families that are living with family members with severe disabilities? So a very, very critical time for the not-for-profit sector in our country. And because we're still so early in this crisis, I'm really hopeful that we can get to the table and to really clearly tell governments how essential these services are right now. And it's not, you know, once they're gone, they're gone. You just can't turn the key again and go, okay, let's go and move it forward. So being creative, making sure that we do as much as we can with the money we have, but it goes to a point for sure.
Well, thanks for that. And just for our listeners to understand, here in Alberta, we actually have the most not-for-profits per capita in the world.
So it goes, we have about 25,000. So we do have a lot, and there could be, and I'm hoping this is also a period of finding more collaborations and people melding together, because there might be too many. But at the same time, most people are doing good. They're servicing communities and really helping people. On a variety of topics, from, you know, domestic violence shelters to people living with disabilities, et cetera, et cetera. It runs the gamut. And we really take it for granted, that sector and the work it does and the safety net it really creates for our society.
Well, absolutely. And another statistic there would be that only 4 out of 10 of not-for-profits actually have paid staff. So it shows you that, like, large parts of the not-for-profit sector is volunteers. And of those 4 out of 10, a good chunk of those employees are actually managing volunteer labor. So if we're not relying on volunteer labor, we have staff that is in the process of managing volunteer labor. And I know in our own not-for-profit, some of the issues that we've sent to the government is with restrictions. For example, granting donors, they'll put strong restrictions on what's allowed to go to operations.
Yes.
They want the money to go to the front lines, forgetting that the people that actually do the work is helping the money to go to the front lines. So I think we could
Unrestricted money there. Right now is essential. And we have gone back to a lot of our funders and donors and just asked that this money could be unrestricted, because we need to be nimble to make big decisions right now. And you're right, what you just said, that the people, that core group that's directing it, we need to be able to fund that, because it's great to have all the programming, but if you don't have the core that's directing it, it doesn't work. And it's been a problem in the not-for-profit sector for a long time. But again, this crisis has just pinpointed how critical it is that we actually fix this.
And if I can just add, like, the group best suited to know how the YWCA of Edmonton should spend the money of YWCA Edmonton is YWCA Edmonton, right? Yeah. Like, and that goes down to whether it's a larger organization like that or a grassroots group, because, you know, it's really hard as often a donor, a person of privilege, you know, not to like get into those tropes. Everyone can be a donor. Everyone should give. But like, if someone has significant assets and wants to give, you know, there's a temptation there to be married to that money and think you might know best. But that grassroots community-based group, they're best poised to know how to serve that community and what's coming up there, and to empower those individuals, I think, is the best thing you can do.
Yeah, particularly during a crisis, like it's just, we have to be nimble and quick, because we're going day to day here and trying to make sure we can move to where the needs are and listening to the community. And it's not normal days where we have weeks to make decisions. We're making them hourly, daily. And we've been around for 113 years. So we've been through many, you know, world wars, Spanish flu, Great Depression. We've navigated those before, and this is what we do well, and we really want to be able to succeed and help as much as we can in this crisis.
So we've kind of segued into this, the next topic really well, which is about government relief policies and different announcements that they've made since, you know, this has all happened. But Jake, you're in BC, so feel free to bring in the BC perspective and what the BC government doing differently than Alberta. That would be really interesting to hear. Alicia and I have been talking for over the past month or so about how, you know, the focus has been on the oil and gas sector in Alberta, you know, ever since the UCP government came into power, even before then. But anyway, it was really focused on oil and gas sector. We already had high unemployment rates, a lot of male high unemployment rates. And then now, you know, shit hits the fan and COVID-19 came and it's disrupted everything. Our oil and gas sector has continued, price of oil has continued to plummet. A lot of these male workers will have maxed out their EI already. What are your thoughts on that? And then also just a quick, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how government policies are affecting, like, are they good? Are there any good ones out there? Are there creative ones? Are there some that they've announced that have had, that you think would have negative consequences or weren't fully thought through? And Alicia and I have been chatting a lot about how, you know, our government has focused on oil and gas for so long, which is male dominated. And they recently, you know, injected a lot of cash into TC Energy to start the Keystone XL pipeline, which again, male dominated. And then, you know, stripped funding away from education, which is female dominated. So it's interesting to see the prioritization of these different gendered occupations.
You know, it's been frustrating because it's a crisis. So people are kind of making it up as they're going, and you can see the governments, particularly from the federal response, a lot of it's been good, but for example, on the wage subsidy, that is a great program in theory, and it will help organizations like ours get through this, like kind of bridges through this crisis, because, you know, we have a large payroll and we need to be able to carry people as long as we can to get through this. The problem is it's moving really slowly. It's unclear the details. We're not sure if we qualify. The money doesn't come till May. I know that the Prime Minister talked today about trying to address that concern for the not-for-profit, but it's not, we were the last ones kind of reflected in that, you know, the not-for-profit, again, just kind of at the bottom of the pile and not really taken into account at the beginning, which, you know, going back to my past comments, there's a real need for us to be at the top of the line as far as making sure we survive this. It's going to be, you know, I like seeing some of the CERB, so people can apply to get instant money. That's really good for people who are need the cash right now to pay rent and keep groceries, you know, things like that, that's need the money now. And that, you know, affects a lot of women as far as, you know, if you're on the margins, you don't have a lot of money, you're a low income earner, you'll need that money. And so that stuff has been helpful. But for organizations in the not-for-profit, it hasn't been a fully cooked policy yet. And And that's been frustrating. And I know that we have the YWCA Canada. I know other larger not-for-profits have their, you know, mother organizations kind of advocating on our behalf in the federal government. I know it's on the radar, but it's, you know, we're almost a month into this crisis and it's still just not a top priority.
I think from our perspective, you know, we are a significantly smaller organization just in terms of staffing and budget and all those kinds of things. And our work is primarily in kind of culture change work as well too. And I think, you know, from my perspective as a citizen right now, you know, I think any funding that is going should be going towards kind of those frontline crisis responses and whatnot, but we can't lose sight of that culture change work, right? Like, because if we're thinking about where these resources are going, you know, you'd mentioned kind of the male dominated industries versus the female dominated industries. One of the biggest issues is, you know, the socialization of men to still exist within this man box. And when they step outside of the man boxes, the penalties are severe for them in and around, you know, homophobia, misogyny, those kinds of things. It's anti-queer, anti-feminine, right? And so, you know, they lose their identity as a breadwinner of significant amount, right? Like those were exorbitant salaries that existed in that industry. And they're having a really hard time adjusting and coping to different types of roles. You know, in my capacity advising with the Calgary Immigrant Women's Association, lots of very qualified individuals come to Canada because that's how we've structured our immigration, engineers, doctors, brilliant researchers, et cetera, et cetera. But they can't find work in their field because their accreditation doesn't come over here. Meanwhile, their female partner just gets a job at Tim Hortons or as a cleaner or something like that because, you know, they need to feed the family. And it causes a lot of tension and domestic violence in those relationships. And, you know, we're gonna see that now. We're gonna see people who've over-leveraged themselves and who, you know, feel that, you know, if they just weren't alive anymore, their family would benefit from the life insurance or you know, this burden, those kinds of things. That is where that culture change work that comes in. That is where we need to have mobilization of individuals to help young men and older men kind of navigate their identities through this crisis, right? So I think as we think of supports and whatnot, we need to not lose sight of those longer term things of what kind of country, what kind of society, what kind of culture do we want to be? And then just the one thing that came to mind in and around differences between governments, we need to be evidence-based. I know that everything's happening very fast right now, but like a very clear difference that I've witnessed from being in Alberta and living in BC now, you know, how the UCP government in Alberta has stripped away a lot of the safe consumption sites. Meanwhile, through this pandemic in the downtown east side, which is, you know, Canada's worst situation in and around addiction and overdose rates and those kinds of things, this crisis has accelerated a conversation around safe supply, right? And so in this period of time, they can isolate for a period of time, give themselves their daily methadone so that they can get through this as well too. And that's just a conversation that didn't happen before, but it's evidence-based. And this has kind of created that space where we can move that forward. So I just think it's really important to have that analysis and evaluation to make decisions, even though they're happening on that hourly and day-to-day basis right now.
And I would say from our point of view, from EWSN, with us working within the school system so much, a lot of our problems, we're very fortunate that some of our donors are saying, like, we understand what's going on, like an NSERC's going, you get another year, so don't worry about it. Because how can you work within the education system when there's no schools open? So yeah. A lot of our issues are going to, and this is what we've mentioned to the government, is thank you for the immediate support, but we're actually going to need support 6 months from now, that we're actually doing okay right now with the funding that we have, but we have no idea if our donors will even exist at the end of this. So the groups that we rely on that give us funds every year to help us with what we do, we have to see if they're okay before we will know if we're okay. So there's going to be some lag time with some of this, the support groups that, like you mentioned, Jake, where we don't even know if we can exist in the future versus now. And other groups that we work with, like Inclusion Alberta, are really pointing to, especially with the biggest, I would say the biggest mistake that has happened in Alberta was the laying off of 25,000 support workers within the education system. Inclusion Alberta actually just wrote a letter and mentioned this, like, we are forgetting about the ones that need the most support. And as we have parents at home juggling the jobs, juggling the healthcare, juggling all the work that they do, anyone who has a child that has any kind of additional needed supports are losing them with the change in that system. And the food banks, connecting students that usually get breakfast programs to the food banks now. These are the people that could have been that link. And I feel like sometimes, you don't see it very often, but even I feel Kenny in his news briefings, he would never admit that he's done a mistake, but just the way he answers some of the reporter questions, I feel like even he is kind of like, well, it's too late now, we did it. But the fact that he will talk about that one more than any other decision that he's made, I feel even it shows you that that decision was made and quickly without actually thinking of the consequences from a gendered and an intersectional lens. Yeah. So I do feel that sometimes decisions are made very quickly without thinking of the domino effect that can be caused. And I know with our group, it'll be very hard to get up and running again until the schools are up and running again and that everyone's okay, and to make sure they have the funding that they need in the fall. Because if we do not give the education system, for example, the funding that we've taken away, they will be even more stretched in order to help all of the kids, right? So definitely from our point of view, ours is, we don't know the full effects.
And I always think about, like, you know, Alberta loves a conversation around meritocracy, right? And if we want to exist in a meritocratic society, we need to invest in healthcare and education. If you're healthy and you're educated, you get opportunities, right? Like, you know, there's other intersectional issues in and around that, but those are kind of the basic building blocks of a healthy and thriving society. And we can see that in others around the world. And so to see the stripping of, you know, in a pandemic, healthcare workers' wages, and like even just having that conversation right now, and then the mass layoff of those teaching assistants and aides, it makes me really wonder what is the prerogative here.
And just to kind of expand on that, let's chat a bit about leadership and how, just like in a company, the tone or level of panic is often set from the top. And there's, you know, world leaders out there like President Trump, who call this the Chinese virus, right? Which is sparking panic and mass racism and xenophobia. And then, but what we'd like your thoughts on as well is the female leadership that's really shining throughout this pandemic, with the incredible chief medical officers in the different provinces, and even the government of Canada chief medical officer, and how they're setting a very different tone and creating kind of new role models.
That's been the silver lining, I think, in a lot of this, the beginning of the crisis, that, you know, the people who provided the most calm, decisive, you know, really strong leadership were women. You know, Dr. Dina Henshaw, she's become a cult figure. Kids are coloring her picture in our province. If you had told me 6 months ago that a chief medical officer of health would be a folk hero in Alberta, you just would be like, what? It makes no sense. So it's really,
I'm wearing her dress today, by the way, everybody.
Yeah. See, like that, she's on t-shirts. And, you know, even around the world, New Zealand's prime minister has been a magnificent, just masterclass in strong, decisive, calm leadership during a crisis. Because people, you're right, Marcy, the tone starts at the top, and how the leaders at the top conduct themselves, and they kind of come out and show, you know, yes, this is a crisis, but we have a plan. We're working on it. We're going to bring everybody together, make sure no one's left behind, is really important. And, you know, just even going back to Dina Henshaw, her language, you know, saying things like, this is an extraordinary time that deserves extraordinary kindness. To use those words are really, I don't know, I look back in history and you don't see that type of leadership, which is so compassionate and bringing people together. And I think it's been really helpful. And there have been the, you know, the Trumps and the bad examples, but I think the good, strong, particularly female leadership, and even I'm nonpartisan here, but even going to Trudeau at the beginning when he was self-isolated and still doing all the home care while his wife was recovering from COVID, you know, that is that's on a strong message, you know, that this guy's running the country at his house and still the dad and doing all of the work and helping with all the home care and taking on all those responsibilities. That's symbolism at its best. And I think it's been really interesting to see. Again, we're not even midway through this crisis and there's a long way to go, but I've been really, really, it's been a very, really good thing to see and very science-based and very fact-based leadership. And that's been really, really great to see.
Catherine, you stole both my answers. I was going to talk about Narder and Justin Trudeau. No, but I think there's so many lessons to learn. And I just think about, you know, in my workshops and whatnot, I talk a lot about how we exist in patriarchy. And there's a lot of people who want to brush that off. But like, if we look at the statistics, you know, Fortune 500 companies, 32 out of 500 CEOs are female. If we look at global heads of state, 7% globally are female, right? So for the individuals who do rise to those ranks of leadership, they are often exceptional individuals who've overcome so much. And to do that and maintain that human aspect is just so inspiring, because I know, you know, I just pulled up here, Deloitte did a report on the design of the everyday man last year. I use it a lot in my work as well, but you know, oftentimes men are socialized, you know, it's on me, I have to do this myself, I can handle this. Second is I'm terrified of failure, right? So I'm going to like overcompensate and do those kinds of things. I can't turn to anyone. I can't ask for help, get through this, you know, in a collaborative way. It needs to be individualistic. And then I don't have role models. I don't have people that are showing me it's okay to be vulnerable and to do those kinds of things. And with those blinders in terms of our socialization coming up, you know, again, Jacinda Ardern classifying the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy as essential workers for children, Angela Merkel having a specific press conference to address children's concerns, right? Like that is sensitive, kind, strong leadership. And there's so much for us to learn from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was just going to add to that. I also want to give credit where credit is due, the fact that our leaders are working together. And considering how, I would say, combative we've been over the last few years, I have to give credit where credit is due and thank our leaders of the provinces and at the federal level for working together at a time when they don't have to, or it's not a common practice. So I do have to say that has been impressive.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So I think this has been a really fantastic kind of comprehensive discussion on different gendered issues and equity issues around COVID-19. But I want to give you, each of you, Catherine and Jake, the floor one more time. If there's anything that we missed or anything you'd like to add or point people to. So we'll start with you, Catherine.
You know, this is a great discussion because I don't think it is on a lot of people's radar, and I want people to think deeper about what's happening and just the longer term ramifications. And you know, just from a not-for-profit sector, support the ones that you really believe in and reach out right now, even if it's a $10 per month donation. That money right now is doing really important work. And like I said, the demand is going up while, you know, our funds are going down. And so it's a really concerning time. But, you know, I've seen a lot of creative things being done in the not-for-profit sector, and that's exciting. And a lot of our work helps vulnerable communities, and it needs to continue. And I just really hope that spirit that we just talked about of people coming together, that collective, you know, we're all in this together and no one's left behind, continues.
I'm really grateful for the opportunity to have this discussion as well. Yeah, the only thing I would kind of point people towards for us, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening, a lot of conversations men don't traditionally have in and around caregiving and stress and self-care, those kinds of things. And we wanted to be there for those conversations. Normally, we have them on a monthly basis in 7 communities across Canada. We've taken those online. So if you look up Next Gen Men Circle of Care on nextgenmen.ca, we've had about 20 plus men on each call talking about all kinds of issues. So, you know, I encourage any listener who's looking for that space, whether it be for themselves or for their partners, and the conversations are open to people of all genders as well. So that's what I would plug. I appreciate the opportunity.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Before we go, we always have to say that we want to remind everybody about the resource section that we have for our podcast. And I've actually already started creating quite a list of resources for our conversation today for people to reference to. And once again, you can find our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Buzzsprout. And please hit subscribe to be notified when a new episode will be released.
Yeah, and feel free to continue the discussion on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Okay.